Okay, here we are live. I hit the go live button a little before everyone was ready, but this is what happens with professionally produced shows.
That's the way we roll.
Exactly. This isn't a professionally produced show. It's a meeting that we decided to record and let the public listen in on. This is The Refinery, Episode 7, July 27th, 2014. I'm Leslie with Conservative Union, and we got JD and Felicia with Free Radical Network. First off, freeradicalnetwork.com is on its way back. Is that not the case?
It is. It is. It is. It is. And I'm just so thankful. At TX Brass, our guy in charge of the website now is working diligently to get us back to functionality. We hope to have some articles back up soon. No real dates yet, but there's a site up at least, and our Facebook page and Twitter feed is on there, and hopefully we're going to get back from that quickly, because man, it was rough. I know Fishy has been. Well, she's still kind of in denial that anything has happened to the website, so...
La 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 la, I'm not listening to JD.
Right, so that's gonna be a thing. When she finally has the ability to post some articles, like I'm worried about her, because she might actually explode from the amount of content that she's trying to, you know, suppress. She's got so much... pent up that she wants to write. It's not a good situation. It's very dangerous. If you are in the Houston area, I would be aware of the dangers. So be careful.
Well, I'm in Northwest Houston. I'm certainly not going southwest to the Katy area. I'm going to be avoiding it.
Yeah, the blast radius is got to be, you know, it's massive at this point.
Yeah. I'm trying to log into the chat thing right now because I forgot to do that earlier. And I apparently don't know my password. Oh, my God. I love it when a plan comes together, because it's nothing at all like this. I can tell you that on your website, the RSS feed thing works already, because there was the initial... Hi, hello everyone post that he put up saying Free Radical Network is back online, and I heard about it, or I found out about it, because my RSS feed had that article, and it no longer had the little warning Free Radical Network is dead icon. It had an article posted, and it showed the author of the article, it showed the title of the article, and it had the content of the article. So your RSS feed stuff is fine.
Yay!
So that's a little bit of good news.
Absolutely.
And it did, like I said last week, it did encourage me to put backup software on my WordPress installation. So.
Yes, backup all the things. That is something that we've learned from this experience. Thankfully, we have all of the articles saved, as far as we know. And
you do? That's great.
Yes, those should be coming back up eventually at some point.
Well, that's very good. That's very good. I'm still trying to find my chat room password.
Password. While we're on the topic of how well stuff is doing, I just want to thank everybody who listens and who watches for what is the best week we've had thus far. Again, I mean, this is...
I was about to say, last week was the best week that we've had thus far.
Right, but this week was even better than that. We had two videos that you know, two of our clips got huge. The Dana Lash clip, it exploded. It's up there. It's got like 170 views, which is really nice for us.
It was over 100 within 12 hours. That was pretty awesome.
Yes, and... And the part two video to I Love the Reason You're Liberal also did really, really well. So and the rest of the videos all made it into the mid-40s, mid-50s. So it was a really good week for us as far as that goes. So hopefully we can continue that trend and make some more content that you guys like. And with that,
I'm in. I'm into the chat room. Woohoo!
Congratulations. Awesome.
Oh, Fishy, I don't know if you saw one of the most recent posts that I put out on Google Plus. The vice prime minister of Turkey, let me see if I can find this post. He has said that women should not laugh in public.
Yes.
Okay. And what he said, I want to read his quote if I can scroll through it. Again, like I said, when a plan comes together, a woman must keep her moral rectitude. She must not laugh out loud in public, stated the Turkish Vice Prime Minister Bülent Arınç, sparking a controversy Tuesday in Turkey. So this recording is being broadcast to the public, and it's being recorded and will be around forever, much as pretty much every clip that comes through of the refinery. There's me laughing in public all the time. I'm just going to say, dear Turkish Vice Prime Minister Bülent Arınç, I laugh in your general direction. Ha! Fishy, would you like to laugh in public as well?
No, I said, of course, on mute, I thumb my nose at you. Had to do it.
So now we've lost all of our Turkish viewers. Is that what I'm taking to understand?
That dang Turkish demographic, we've totally kissed it.
We've totally killed our Turkish demographic. That is
well, horrible. just the Turkish Islamists, reasonable people, and
but we were doing so well among the Turkish Islamists.
Yeah. When I first heard this story, of course, my instinct was to ask whether the Turks, Turkish women, were going to stage a laugh-in.
That'd be great, a laugh-in.
Wow. Yay.
The problem is they couldn't use the phrase, suck it to me, probably.
No, because that would be taken literally. That'd be a little dangerous, I
think. Yes.
A little dangerous.
So, yeah.
Actually, my best friend in high school, one of my two best friends in high school, was Turkish, Shula Berelgen, and her dad worked with the embassy here. And I learned some Turkish, none of which I could say here because we have a profanity filters, but it was actually handy when we would go out to clubs when we got, you know, a little older when we were all in college, we would go out to clubs and people would say, oh, hey, baby, you want to dance? And we would respond with kusmak istiyorum, which is Turkish for I want to throw up. And so he's saying, do you want to dance? And you're saying, oh, no, kusmak istiyorum. Do you want to dance? No, I want to throw up. And they'd go, and wander away and think we were foreign.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so now we've gone beyond losing our Turkish demographic to annoying them, and you really don't want to annoy the Turkish Islamic demographic. It's not a good idea. So
no, probably
not. On that note, let's go to some other annoyed people. Can we do that?
Well, let's introduce Delbert, who has not been to the refinery before. Delbert is here now this week, lives in Oregon. I have actually been lucky enough to meet Delbert in person because he was coming through Houston on a work event and made that known in public. And so Felicia and I went and met him at a bar in Houston and talked and had a great old time.
It was a great time. So I thought I'd show up tonight to be the token turkey.
So you're gonna shame us for laughing or something?
Yes. No,
that will never ever work. But anyway, let's get down to business. JD wanted to talk about Rand Paul and the audacity of talking to black people.
Yeah, it is absolutely amazing. So Rand Paul, I mean, it's for anybody who's actually been watching the refinery, it's not a surprise that I'm a big fan of Rand Paul. A big supporter of Rand Paul. I think that he's doing a lot of what we really need to do to grow the party, to win elections, and he goes out and he helps out conservative candidates all across the country and does a great job. you know, one of the reasons why I'm such a big supporter is because last year he came out and helped Steve Lonergan here in New Jersey try and combat Cory Booker in the special election. And, you know, I think that some of the seeds that he planted there last year are helping out now. You can see some interesting poll results saying that Cory isn't doing quite as well as he was projected to do. But one of the things that I think Rand does better than most of our candidates, most of our representatives, not just in D.C., but as a party, is communicate to non-traditionally Republican voters. He's, you know, recently he's gone to Silicon Valley to talk to a bunch of the techies over there and try and win some of their support. They've got a lot of money, very deep pockets, and are, you know, instrumental in shaping the culture, really, going forward with Facebook and Twitter and all of these things. But he's also gone to traditionally black colleges. He's gone to, communities that are, you know, left out to dry in a lot of ways. And last week he went to the National Urban League's meeting in Cincinnati, and this appearance, which the speech is amazing. He speaks for around 20 minutes and talks about a lot of different things. Inspired Stephanie Rawlings Blake, the mayor of Baltimore and secretary of the Democratic National Committee, to come out and write a response saying, "Blacks shouldn't be fooled by Rand Paul." And I think that that's really telling.
Sorry, I had mute on. I was really going to jump in there.
you said brilliant things, right?
It was just... I was, totally. As always. God. But no, seriously, the very fact that he makes these sort of reactions happen, and people can look for themselves and read the transcript or watch the 20 minutes of what he said, and then read this rebuttal and response, and get two different, completely different things. And especially the people that were there that are, reading this later. What an interesting picture that other people are getting completely different messages out of what he said. There were quite a few applause lines in his speech that people responded positively to. There was no one standing up on their feet and cheering, but they were very, very receptive to some of the things that he was saying. And there's just this criticism, this backlash coming. How dare he? I think the major criticism of it was that a person can be a minority by their ideology instead of just their skin color or, say, sexual orientation or whatever, that they can be a minority based on their ideology. And I would argue that is, of course, the most important minority to be protected. But that was the sort of thing that ruffled feathers. How dare he attempt to compare a condition one's born with one's beliefs. It was bizarre to see the criticism, but good for him to stir up, liberal ire. I think it's lovely.
And I think it's a really good thing that he is doing this. He's just going and showing up, and he knows that he's going to take a hit for this stuff. And maybe in large part that's step one, is that we get Republican candidates and Republican voices to show up to the black community and to the Hispanic community and the Asian community and take those hits and be kind of the vanguard of, yes, you can go to the meeting, you can be verbally berated for it, but you live through it. And, that gets us through the first step. And then maybe the next wave of guys that show up and talk at these things, maybe they actually are listened to a little bit. And then maybe after that, I think it's a gradual step-by-step thing. And I'm glad that Rand Paul is doing the early stuff now when we're more than 2 years out from, really a presidential politics. And it's maybe he's kind of like drawing fire in the early days of getting them to accuse him of being racist for showing up, and he's racist for not showing up, and you're bad when you ignore us, and you're bad when you come talk to us, and to kind of expose that. I mean, I don't know if that's what he's doing, but it's kind of working out that way.
Well, the neat thing was that he didn't say anything in this speech that I hadn't heard him say to other audiences, white or not. There was nothing new here. This was not a tailored for the Urban League speech. This is his speech. This is the thing he talks about. These are the items he hits when he makes speeches. So I was pleased to see that, because so often we're accused in the conservative movement of wanting to water down the message or change it when we go to different communities. That's not what he's doing. You can find YouTube after YouTube where he's saying the same things to different audiences. And if we talk about our politicians not being, you know, playing one side one way and one side another and attempting to stir up this group and then use that language with that group, that's not this guy. And that makes me very, very impressed. I really like that. And it does sort of eliminate some of that criticism that people have of, well, they're just saying that because they're in front of that audience. That's not what's happening.
It's one thing I appreciate about Rand Paul is he is a good communicator, and he communicates what he wants to, and he doesn't give off any sense that he's worried about what people think about him, because he's assured in what he's doing is the right thing.
Yeah, and it also helps that he's got a really good message that applies to everyone. It's a very, you know, wide base of appeal that he generates with what he has to say. Freedom, in fact, should be easy to sell, and I think he does a very good job of making it look easy to sell. In his speech, you know, Fishy said it's not tailored to that specific audience any more so than it was tailored to us at CPAC when we saw it. He used the same examples. He used the same examples of Martin Luther King talking when he was talking about Fourth Amendment rights, because Martin Luther King Jr.'s, you know, phones got tapped. That happened. That's something that actually happened, and I don't think that people were too keen about that happening to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I don't think that they should be happy about that happening to them in their personal lives, to have metadata collected and have all of this information, you know, on tab for the government to figure out, oh, hey, we could probably use this right now, or this is something that we want to look at, or where was this person at this particular point in time? Going into mandatory minimum sentencing, he's similar examples there. The stuff that he has to offer and the way that he presented it, while not really different from the CPAC speech, it went over fairly well to this audience. And it's who else is bringing this message to these communities? Who else is doing it? Who else is bringing the message of freedom and liberty and limited government and, you know, the ability to defend yourself and the ability to not have your privacy infringed upon? Who else is doing that in these communities? Is it the left? Is Harry Reid doing it? I don't see that.
The article that I just posted in chat from Politic365 was where I first heard about the reaction to Rand's speech. And the writer in question compares Rand's legislative record, the bills he's sponsoring or you know, attaching and pushing, to the Democrat record on the same issues. And it's fascinating. And people who are, this is an urban blog that's been noting these things, that, hey, here's this guy with a record in the Senate that you can point to and look at and see the things he sponsored on criminal justice reform, mandatory minimums, ending that, nonviolent offenses having their sentences reduced, you know, reclassifying the way that, that cocaine convictions happen and that sort of thing. He's got a record of sponsoring bills on these things. And the very people in the Senate who are supposed to be the champions of minorities and all the things that, that are supposed to be positive and Democrat, those people are nowhere on these issues. That is a fascinating contrast.
And that's the kind of thing that we need to be playing up a little bit more. The issues that Rand Paul is really driving seem to be, to me, to be the kind of non-standard conservative issues that the public is really very concerned with. I mean, we know that 90% of the public is actually on our side with regard to immigration, and that topic is getting a lot of news and a lot of conversation. So there's, you know, there's a lot of attention being paid to the immigration border crisis issue. But what isn't getting as much notice is NSA privacy issues, mandatory minimum sentencing, releasing of nonviolent offenders, and a lot of the some of the issues that we've heard Rick Perry bring up and we've heard Rand Paul bring up, and both of them do so quite successfully. Those are issues that I think it's clear both of those guys genuinely care about those issues, because they see that our failures on those things have been detrimental to society in general. And, you know, I think Rick Perry comes at it from the standpoint of, you know, running the state and his evangelical background of wanting the, you know, the social conservatism, restoration of the family kind of angle on it. And Rand Paul comes at it from a very libertarian view, but it's kind of the thing where you can see that two guys who have different, you know, maybe a different angle can come at the issues that they see a problem and they see the same solution that benefits both of their priorities, and their priorities are kind of different but complementary. And I think that's the kind of thing that we can use to expand the conservative movement, because you have the religious right on, you know, that. And I don't want to say that Rick Perry represents the religious right, but he is the guy that did the big evangelical thing at the Astrodome. So whatever that was, that Church of Christ, you know, movement, whatever that was.
The Toyota Center thing?
Yeah.
Okay. Nothing happened in the Astrodome for quite a while, I'm just saying.
Yeah. It was a few years ago, but he's much more of the evangelical, from the evangelical side of healing society, but not the big government way of things like Huckabee is. You know, it's like they both have the religious evangelism core, but Huckabee takes it to a big government side, and Rick Perry takes it to a heal your soul and let your family fix it rather than the government fix it. And then you have Rand Paul, and I don't know Rand Paul's religious background, but he is very much more of the libertarian side of things. He's not going to really, he doesn't seem to even talk about his religious background all that much. But it's cool to me that both of them approach the mandatory minimum sentencing and the over-incarceration problem. They both see it as a problem, one worthy of discussion and one with a similar solution of freeing the nonviolent offenders. It gives you more capacity in your jails for the real bad guys, and, you know, focus your law enforcement efforts on things that really are worthwhile, and not so much of this stupid top-down mandatory minimum take the decision away from the judge kind of thing.
Well, and that reminds me that not only did Rand Paul in this speech use examples and stories, like the three young black men who were standing at a corner and were told to move on and didn't because they were waiting for a bus to take them to their game, and they were arrested for that. I mean, that sort of thing is very powerful when people hear that. And, right. And even people who've never had, you know, never seen racial discrimination in their life can relate to that, can understand that. But at the same time, if you saw the John Stossel show that he put on last weekend about privacy.
Fabulous, by the way, that was fabulous.
He's talking about the same things. Mm-hmm. He's talking about the mandatory minimums, and he got on with Lise Wheel from Fox News about why mandatory minimums she thought were great, and it's because it gives the power to the prosecutors. Well, do you want that? Do you really want that? You know, there's some advocacy that you expect out of a prosecutor for public safety and whatnot, but really, it's a club. It's a weapon. It's not... Mandatory minimums are just made to make a prosecutor's job easier. And there's a whole bunch of arguments for and against that people will make. But the fascinating thing is that this is getting play in the culture. Can you find anybody in media that's more well-liked and trusted than John Stossel? Really? I think it's fabulous that we have messengers, not just Rand Paul out there doing it politically, but John Stossel picking it up media-wise. And being a consumer reporter for so long, people have he's got a lot of goodwill built up, and people really like and respect him. And when he says the same things, it's easier, I think, to get conservatives around making those same arguments.
Well, particularly since it will be conservatives arguing against policies that they pushed for 30 and 40 years ago. And it can be an example of us saying, look, we thought it was a great idea, we were wrong, and we need to undo that which we pushed for. And we know that there are a lot of judges and a lot of senators, John Cornyn, that got their elected position on the backs of mandatory minimums and tough on crime. And we know that the stereotype of the conservative politician is, I'm tough on crime and I'm going to throw everybody in prison forever and throw away the key. But hey, guys, we now have statistics, we now have results of it, we can see, and the facts don't bear it out, and the facts are we've got an awful lot of people incarcerated who should not be. And we need to put the decisions back in the hands and the judgment in the hands of the judge, not the judgment in the hands of the congressman who's writing the law, who is far removed. I want the judgment in the hands of the judge who's looking the person in the face. And we need to, and I think we as conservatives can have more credibility with repealing some of these laws because it was our fault and we did the wrong thing.
I wouldn't even say that it's our fault too much. I mean, take credit for whatever it is that we did. But a case that's in the news recently that Free Radical Network shared on Facebook today about the guy who was put into a chokehold in New York City and was killed by policemen his crime was selling single cigarettes out to people in New York because it's, you know, ridiculous the amount of regulations that they have on cigarettes in New York City. So in order to circumvent that, there's a black market, and he was, you know, making money selling single cigarettes to people walking on the street. The response from what was it, the DA, I think, the assistant DA, talking about, oh, well, it's still a crime. Oh, well, you know, just you don't want me to enforce all these laws or whatever. The way that it was presented was just amazingly out of touch. Amazingly out of touch.
It was completely callous.
Absolutely callous. And this is not a Republican by any stretch of the imagination. This is de Blasio's New York City that we're talking about. And I'm not going to be shocked if this is something that, follows a trend, that this trend is something that progresses throughout the country as far as Democrats are concerned. I'm sure that there are a lot out there who don't really want to see movement on mandatory minimum sentencing, or think that it's a bad thing to repeal those bills. So I would be very interested to see how the lines of battle are drawn on these issues. I want to see who exactly is with Rand Paul and who isn't, who's with the de Blasio camp.
I'll take responsibility for supporting those kinds of laws in the past, and that's seems to be like a natural thing that people do. They find something they don't like, And they say, we need a law to prevent that. And then you find out afterwards that the law you created is applied with a blanket approach and causes much more problems than what you were trying to resolve. And it's so unfair to certain people because you have created such laws.
Well, and we get this in our lives. Can anyone say zero tolerance policy?
I was just thinking of the schools with the zero tolerance. And I think there are so many threads that we can tie in with this story. We can tie it to the lack of competence that we see in big government applying a bunch of these laws that we're creating too many of. And it's a lack of personal responsibility. Because what's more delightful when you have a mandatory minimum or zero tolerance? You see a kid doing something, and you are freed from the personal responsibility of judging that child or determining what that child's punishment is. It's the rules. You can blame it on the rules or the computer system, or it's somebody else's fault. I'm just executing the rules. I didn't make them. It's not my fault. Don't hate me. I'm still your friend, you know, because friends and stuff. But you know, it's this mean rule that I have to follow, sorry. And it absolves me of all responsibility.
Some of it is cultural, because mm-hmm. when you do have discretion in sentencing between, you know, whether it's a kid that's in trouble at school or whether it's a felon or, you know, person convicted of a misdemeanor or whatever, when you have discretion, it sets you up to be the bad guy when there seems to be an inequitable distribution of sentences across different people, across different races. It makes sense for people to want to find some cover and say, right. Well, this is what the law says and I can't do anything about it. It's not me being the bad guy. And that's what you were saying. The problem with that is people looking from the outside are the ones making those judgments that are saying, that's not fair. This guy only got that and that guy got this for the same thing. You need to have that discretionary authority. You've got to be able to take things on a case-by-case basis. Just like we want it applied in schools that way, we should be able to translate that into the criminal justice system easily in understanding why judges need the power, not the attorneys, not the prosecutors.
And not the legislators who are influenced by a... oh my gosh, the prison industrial complex that has financial motivation to have more people in prison. I mean, and then you have conspiracy theories that you can't really argue against and say, oh no, it wouldn't be the prison industrial complex wanting to make more money by having people thrown in prison. Because, you know, quite frankly, prisons make a crap ton of money from having people incarcerated. So, yeah, they have the lobbyists. Well,
and you and I live in Houston, where we've had serious problems with the prosecutor's office, with the district attorney's office for years, mm-hmm. going back 4 years. And it's still not in the proper shape. It's still not being handled properly. This is one of the huge problems I have with, you know, other forms of punishment, like the death penalty. We have untested kits, rape kits, going back years. We have evidence that's been lost or mismanaged or mishandled, and it gives the prosecutor huge incentives to go for plea bargains when they can't make their case, which is just a really horrible thing when you get down to it. So seeing it firsthand on the ground, it's very relatable to us because we've seen cases like that happen here, right close to home.
I just want to point out, again, something that has been a common theme on the refinery, something that we've sort of latched onto, and that's the concept of one size fits all and how big government does that. It accomplishes all of its goals through this idea that one size can fit everyone, and it can't. And that applies to sentencing as much as it applies to healthcare, as much as it applies to what school you send your kid to, all of those things. One size does not fit all, but they try and shoehorn it in, and that's what mandatory minimums are. It is that one size fits all thesis coming back and it always, invariably, hurts people.
A good example and something that I've been incensed about this week is the news of a Boy Scout troop that was held up traveling from Iowa through Canada to Alaska. I don't know if you'd seen that, but they ended up being delayed for 4 hours entering Alaska through our border guards who severely abused power. And I got into a argument or debate about it with someone who said we should just be used to that and expect that. And to me, it's no, I don't expect that, and I'm not going to get used to it, and I'm not going to accept it, that the same one size fits all doesn't work in that situation. And I think people, citizens, are getting too used to that.
That was what scared me so much about the John Stossel special that was Policing America, and I'm sure it's available online at Fox News somewhere. They went into the police state and, you know, all the over-equipment that the cops have, and that there are people who live 100 miles from any border, and they're going through border checkpoints every day. And there are some people that say, well, we should just expect that. And you know, I think after watching that entire show and being kind of terrified and extremely angry and all sorts of, is this even America? Much of what I came away with was that there are so very many laws, and we're trying to enforce all of our laws, and yet there are a lot of laws that we just wink and don't enforce, and then the ones that we are enforcing, we're enforcing badly and wrong. It's like, because we have two huge problems. We're not enforcing the law, and yet we're over-enforcing the law. You know, I as a libertarian conservative, I have two main complaints with the government, and it's mostly federal, and that's that they're not enforcing laws about our border, and yet you've got the Border Patrol doing checkpoints 100 miles in from the 100 miles in from the border, and you know the Border Patrol agents are totally over the top, and they're giving U.S. citizens a rectal exam just to go to work, and yet you have on the Rio Grande, Michelle Bachmann is able to use her iPhone and film a family coming across on a raft. It's that we're applying our resources incorrectly, incompetently, and from the federal government in a one-size-fits-all approach, and it's not working. Government isn't working, and we're spending a crap ton of money on it, and we're not getting any bang for our buck.
And you brought up a good point in that a lot of government agencies, from cities to states to federal, pick and choose which laws they will enforce. In the case of, I live close to Portland, Oregon, they refuse to enforce any immigration laws there. So they make it like a free city for illegal aliens to come in and abide as they please.
Right. Well, as they please and as the rest of the society will pay for, but whatever.
Yeah, this gets back to something else that Fishy shared on Free Radical Network this week, and that's a really great Kevin Williamson article about how the rule of law, based on words and grammar and logic, is something that you really shouldn't mess around with when it comes to enforcing, not enforcing. If there's a bad law, repeal it. But selective enforcement is a really, really slippery slope. That was in reference to the Halbig decision.
Well, and that's where corruption comes in.
Yeah. Talking about the court case with Obamacare and how the states are the only ones that are allowed to set up exchanges, and if they don't, then you know it creates a severe problem with the way that Obamacare is implemented. So, essentially throwing a big wrench into the works. That case is going to the Supreme Court soon, I'm sure. But
right.
This is a serious problem.
It shouldn't be difficult for conservatives to make this argument that when you have a king, and I'm using king in the very most loose term possible. I'm not calling Obama a monarch or anything like that. But when you have someone in power whose word becomes law versus a set law for your society that your ruler enforces of whatever class or rank or position they have, when you have a person's word being law rather than a written code that everyone that doesn't change except by mutual agreement with lots and lots of discussion around it, that makes the difference between someone's arbitrary decisions affecting you and you having your day in court. The nation was built, Western civilization was built on the idea that people were unequal, in the eyes of God is how they originally phrased it. But then there was the equal protection under the law concept that came, where no matter who you were, the top of the chain, the bottom of the chain, you were given a fair hearing. You had the same laws applied to you in the same way. Now, there's some things you can purchase, a certain amount of justice, being richer in this country, obviously. That's just a function of the way that lawyers work and the system works. But you still get a much fairer hearing, generally, than you would in a country where someone just decides what's going to be right and what's going to be wrong. And you don't have to worry about what somebody had for breakfast affecting how they treat your case. That is a completely different, long, long history and tradition of argument over this. And what we're seeing with the arbitrary application of the law in, say, Obamacare's case or immigration or whatever issue you want to say is a very dangerous trend. Now, we can talk about it in the terms of, you know, the law is king and the king is law and which is actually proper. But we've got to find a way to explain that to people so they understand, hey, the next guy that gets in office may not be the guy that likes you and your ideas, and he's the one that's going to be making decisions next. Would you give this power? Maybe this is the question. Would you give this power to a Republican president? Before you'd accept it for your Democrat president, would you let George Bush do this?
I'm not 100% sure that that's the right argument, but it is. And Kevin has mentioned this before in terms of inconsistent application and inconsistent application of the law is the path towards banana republic, and it very much is. I don't know how to message it, but a large part of the reason America was so successful at getting foreign investment through over the last couple hundred years is because we have been reliable and fair and predictable. Companies want to invest in a place where they can predict what laws are going to affect them and their business and how they're going to be applied, and they can predict what their future profit's going to be, what their expenses are going to be, etc. And because we had that predictability in terms of you could look ahead 100 years and know when elections would happen here, what would happen if the parties changed in an election, which is not much. You know, we don't have that so-and-so called for an election. We don't have recall elections. We don't have trauma when the number one party changes. We have a very stable political system, and that allows for a very stable and consistent legal system, and corporations have invested heavily here, and we've become ridiculously wealthy and ridiculously healthy out of it. And we've seen over the last 10, 15 years, as laws have begun to be applied in a much more arbitrary fashion, and how the bigger and richer and more connected you are, the more likely you are to be able to get away with something. We've seen ourselves fall more towards the banana republic way of governing. And companies have started saying, you know, screw that, I'm going to go to Germany. Screw that, I'm going to open up a place in France or Norway. I don't, and it seems to me that that might be an effective way to message instead of, would you like it if George Bush did it? I don't really know. But
I'm not sure either, but it definitely opens the door for, you know, people who have been saying, oh, well, you know, George Bush did it. George Bush, what about the next person? You know, let's say, and, you know, I'm not a fan, God forbid, but let's say Rick Santorum ends up being the next president. Do you want to put that in his
hands? I'm fine with using him as the GOP boogeyman.
Yeah, I'll take that. You know,
we could kill the candidacy before it even starts.
Because you want people to think about, what if the situation were reversed? You want to get that thought into their head in the most shocking way possible.
I suppose that's true.
On the left, I'm talking about the left embedded people. I'm not talking about the people that are, you know, in the middle who really aren't paying attention. I'm really talking about the ideological left. You want to sow that seed in their thoughts, the people who are sort of cheering Obama on for all of his, because we want it. Wasn't that
Oh, yeah, and there are a lot of people on the left that are, the end justifies the means, and it doesn't really matter how or who has to do it. And that's not just on the left. There's a lot of people in our current culture is end justifies the means. As long as it turns out, okay, I don't care whether I had to steal the song. I wanted the song. I don't care. You know, I mean, there's an awful lot of end justifies the means thinking going on. And you're right, maybe scared straight is the way to go, and scare them with the Santorum. Would you like it if Santorum had that same permission that you're giving Obama? You like what Obama's doing, and you like what Harry Reid is trying to do, so you allow this stuff to happen, but you're creating a precedent where the laws can be ignored, and great, if that's the way if that's okay, then we're going to get Rick Santorum in, and you are going to have to go to church.
And that is really kind of where the whole Gruber, is it Paul Gruber? The argument.
Hans Gruber. No, wait.
Oh, not Hans Gruber, I promise. But this week he's been one of the, you know, guy labeled the architect of Obamacare, and he's out there saying, you states, you'd better shore up and get yourself an exchange, because otherwise, you're not going to get any of the federal dollars. Your people are going to be paying for health care in other people's states. And then now that the decision came down and said, no, you absolutely can't settle those subsidies on people in states that don't have an exchange set up, he's saying, oh, well, I misspoke. I had a speco, or instead of a typo, or whatever. This sort of thing, this rewriting of history, as I think it was Charlie Cook said today, is sort of where they're going, because expedience trumps anything. And if we slide into that, if we let that stand in this culture, we are headed in the most, you know, we are on a bobsled to the Banana Republic as fast as we could go. Because you can't say, the law means what I say it means, or what I want it to mean. The words have meaning.
And the law means what I want it to mean now that we're a couple years into it, and yes. I see how things really worked out. I'm going to – what I really meant a couple – because I know I said this a couple years ago, but that was when I thought X was going to happen. But since Y actually happened, what I really – what the law really meant, clearly, of course, and what's amazing is that Gruber and his ilk, they can say this stuff, and – I think they genuinely believe what they're saying, which terrifies me.
Right, because their objective is not to follow the rules and honor the process and get as much done as they can within the process. And if it were, this would be a wholly different type of situation we find ourselves in. Their goal is to get to the end, again, the end justifies the means, no matter what they have to say or do to get it, and no matter how they have to twist it. The whole thing is based upon selling to the American people that the ends justify the means. And there is that trend in, I think, in the reason Rupi poll that they did on millennials, that millennials are a little bit fudgier about how they want things done. They're not so engaged in the process. And that's an interesting development that we need to start reversing. And I think the way we do that is, as we were talking about, that shock to the system. You know, giving someone an outlandish, you know, opposite of what they're talking about. You know, what if, you know, say marriage laws were completely rewritten in a way that you know, not only prohibited gays from, you know, getting into relationships of marriage in states where it's permitted, but eliminating them completely because of the way the law was written, and somebody said, well, I didn't like the way it's written, I'm going to do it this way. Shocking the system, telling people that the concept may work for you on this day, but it's going to come back and bite you the next time.
And the rest there is getting people to see tomorrow and visualize the future, and we're in a very immediate gratification. I don't know.
We are, and another issue is the propaganda has been so good that in general people think, non-Republicans think that the Republican Party is a bad party and the people are bad and the people are selfish. And that even though the Democrat Party is creating laws now that they won't like the Republicans to have in the future, that if there is a Republican president next and he uses these laws, it'll just be quickly painted that this was created by Republicans and the Republicans are abusing it. And I don't know what the solution for that kind of problem is.
It's winning elections. That's the solution. The solution is presenting our case better than they present theirs, and I think that's very doable. One of the ways that would be an interesting example to use is the fact that Harry Reid eliminated the filibuster. The serious powers of the filibuster have been pretty much neutered at this point, so that's something that it might be a little bit harder to explain in a way that is understandable to a wide audience. But you know,
well, yeah, because you say the word filibuster, and I stop listening.
Because you were expecting me to start reading Green Eggs and Ham. That's probably the association your brain made was that. Filibuster, it's time for Dr. Seuss. No, yeah. I think that there are ways to explain, hey, Harry Reid stripped out one of the biggest tools that the minority party has in the Senate. I think that's something that you can totally do, and it eliminates a lot of the defense that, the minority party, minority ideas have, that's perfect intro. I'm sorry, I'm reading chat. Fishy, could you make this point, please?
Well, okay, so I got my copy of Conservative Insurgency. JD's got behind him on the wall, and I started reading it, and one of the best parts was, it's told sort of first person through a bunch of people. Really interesting way that he's written it. Kind of reads like World War Z's narrative did in the book form. That's much better than the movie, by the way. But the way that the passages that just filled me with glee are some of the Schadenfreude-filled passages where the conservatives decide to use all of the liberal tactics against them, and one of which is the fact that the Democrats eliminated the filibuster and then lost the Senate immediately in the next couple of elections. And boom, all of a sudden it was game on. Conservatives were passing things left and right. Under the first Republican president in ages, they managed to get all these things done. That's going to happen if the certain conservative, I guess, coalition that we build gets aggressive. That is going to be one of the first tools that's employed to cut back liberalism. And just the thought makes my mouth water. I believe you will see the rivers of liberal tears flooding the coastal cities when this happens. And it's a delicious thought. And the great thing about that part of the book is it's not just the roadmap that we can follow that maybe can get some things done, but it's the very idea that using non-traditional means, getting out of our comfortable boxes that we're in to get places is the same message, right back to the beginning of the show, that Rand Paul and John Stossel are talking about. The same things, from going to non-traditional communities and talking to people and constituencies that we've never reached out to in ages for a long time, all the way to using tactics like lawfare and using equal access laws to apply to, say, one's ideology instead of just one's one's skin color or sexual preference, or using it to force a university to take people of a particular religion into their student body or whatever. That's pretty genius. It's creative, but it reminds us how we can take those non-traditional things, even now, even in just speeches, and go to non-traditional places and think outside of our usual comfort zone.
Absolutely, and you're right. That is one of the more it was an interesting chapter to read, the chapter on lawfare, and how basically what happens was one of the conservative Republican presidents basically goes in and impeaches several Supreme Court justices, including one that might have been from New York. Spitzer maybe was his name. Impeached a lot of Supreme Court justices and packed the courts, added new justices just because it worked for Roosevelt, that threat.
Well, it didn't actually work for him. He threatened it, but he didn't actually grow the Supreme Court.
Well, the threat...
The packing the court in the narrative in the book refers to impeaching three and renaming three more. It doesn't mean expanding the court.
I'm sorry. My bad.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
Right, and this is wish casting to some extent. But these are goals that we have the ability to achieve, particularly because the left has given us so much leeway. I mean, they've taken it for themselves, and in the process, I mean, what are they going to say? What are they going to say when we get a serious conservative Supreme Court justice in because they can't filibuster? Oh, it's your fault? It's your fault that Harry Reid decided to take it away?
Well, you know they will.
Oh, they can try, but what are you... The answer is right there. Oh, right. No, sorry. This is something that you guys did. You handed us these keys. You used it as a stick.
We're agreeing with you now, so shut up. Yeah.
it's our turn to play with the toys now. Thank you.
And the best part, again, none of this actually has to happen in order for progress to be made. The great thing about it is if people get really squidgy about, say, not allowing the filibuster, using Democrat rule filibusters, then if that's the case, maybe they'll find a comfort level a little further along than they were. Maybe that particular tactic isn't for them. Maybe lawfare makes them feel squidgy, but they can certainly think about another tactic that's brought up that may be a little less skeezy in their mind. I don't know. But just the idea of pushing the bounds of imagination into what we've been able to do is a healthy exercise, no matter how things play out.
Right, like using affirmative action for religious preference and political ideology rather than just skin color, and the gender assignment.
You're obsessed with makeup.
Apparently, I don't know.
Last week it was eyeshadow.
Today it's skincare. I don't know.
It's just because you're both so shallow. That's what it is.
Yes, very much so. I'm totally shallow. And just so girly. I think a lot of what we're talking about, though, is something that kind of ties to a Washington Post article that was this morning at Obama's competence problem. And a lot of I'm seeing a lot of our issues tying into a similar messaging strategy that we could begin to deploy, and that's the competence, one size fits all, and the other one that I forgot. Oh, crap. Because I can't count to three. I don't know how. But young people today, and really everybody now, recognizes that incompetence in government is not a surprise, it's just sort of a given. Unfortunately, that's not being translated to the conclusion of, then we better make it less responsible for things in our lives. You know, if they're incompetent, let's make them also irrelevant, okay? That would seem to make sense, right? But somehow we need to find a way to message the fact that government is incompetent and federal government is more incompetent than most, and they're trying this whole one-size-fits-all thing that they can't even do any of it right at all, and we need to find a way to message and have that be sort of the overarching theme of all Republican libertarian ideas that are pitched, because also our problem is that Republicans and libertarians, every single person has their own policy proposal. And that then ends up, because there are so many, it ends up being translated as there are none. You know, we hear Republicans want to repeal Obamacare, but they don't have any solution. Well, actually, we have 400,000 solutions because we want to try individual labs at the state and county level, and that's actually the way things work better. But we don't have a way to message the fact that our millions of solutions are the solution. Because one size fits all is not an answer. Obamacare is one size fits all. We have a million different sizes and options rather than one big option. We're not going to, you know, repeal and replace big bad with one big bad. That's a big conservative bad. And, you know, and it's similar on the whole the welfare thing. Paul Ryan got a lot of press earlier this week because he came out with a big wonky welfare poverty proposal and was on a couple of news shows talking about that. And it was loudly touted as, wow, it's about time a Republican starts talking about welfare and poverty. What? They all have welfare poverty programs. We talk about that all the time. But because there isn't one welfare poverty solution like raise the minimum wage that we all rally behind, and that's not a bug, that's a feature. The way the libertarian conservative philosophy works is we don't all rally behind a single solution. Our answer is multiple answers. But because we haven't figured out a way to explain that effectively, and I'm not doing so, I'm taking 5 minutes to explain it, that we have multiple answers.
I'm sorry, I need to interrupt you. You did a very good job, and it's probably going to be clipped out and put on the internet in a few hours, what you just said. So, I think you did a remarkably good job of just saying what our response is. It's not one size fits all. It's multiple choice. I think that is a perfect response. That makes sense.
The third thing you were looking for must have been energy.
Oh, most likely, yes. Being from Texas, energy is one of the things that I'm always looking at, and I agree with Rick Perry. I always forget about the Department of Energy. Yeah, I caught that.
Every time. The poor guy, he can't catch a break. That's why he's not a serious presidential candidate, because
Because he forgot that one thing once.
No one is going to let him live that down, or any of the other things that he's had a few more of them recently that he can't blame on the back pain. So
president has never had a talk how to speak o. So, but he's black.
Not in any of the 57 states that he's visited.
I gotta say, it's a little depressing that I'm so deep into politics that whenever I hear someone list off three things and they forget the third, that I default to energy as the punchline. Non-political people who look at me like, what does that have to do with anything?
Well, you know, when I said I couldn't remember the third, that I was absolutely thinking of Rick Perry. You know I was thinking of that. And then when you came back and said energy, I got it instantly. We are such dorks.
That's the thing. You couldn't remember it because you were thinking too much about energy. That's the thing. It was eating, you know, all of your thoughts because you couldn't focus on what the actual third thing was. You had to think of energy.
Yeah, exactly. But we have a problem with our own side in understanding, in getting past the Democrat top-down thinking of you have to have a single plan. I even had in the conversation about Paul Ryan's welfare plan when let me go to this link. He announced it at the American Enterprise Institute. And it was shared to the Conservative Union with the comment, he's talking about things no other conservative is talking about. And I'm like, just a nitpick. Other conservatives are indeed talking about this. And I went on to say, it's just not all the same thing. And, you know, and Pradeep, and it was with Pradeep Shankar, he and I were talking about this, and he said, I think the key here going forward is to take these bunch of ideas, meaning the bunch of ideas that all of our candidates have about poverty and welfare, and come up with 1 to 3 items that we can all mostly get behind. We can't have 12 different proposals with myriad of intricate details. We need broad brushstrokes. And that's kind of true, but kind of also not. We need broad brushstrokes in messaging the concept so that we do, in fact, have 12 different proposals with a myriad of intricate details that every single politician can talk about. And I'm fine with that. I kind of want that, more people thinking more deeply about stuff. But we as conservatives need to find a way to understand that the conservative way is we're going to have 12 different proposals, and they're all going to have intricate details. But we need to tie them together with 1 to 3 broad brush strokes of message. Doesn't mean we have 1 to 3 broad proposals that everybody's agreeing on the Mike Lee plan. Everybody can have their own plan. Mike Lee has his way of getting to points 1, 2, and 3. Paul Ryan has his way of getting to points 1, 2, and 3. Susana Martinez has her way of getting to points 1, 2, and 3. You notice I used her today. I remembered her today. So I think our side needs to understand and get better about combining all of our 12 different proposals or our 100 different proposals under the same 3 bullet points. And it doesn't have to be 3 bullet points about poverty programs. It can be 3 bullet points about the conservative prosperity message. And this welfare program will help achieve it, and that immigration program helps to achieve it, and this Ex-Im Bank proposal helps achieve those, and every single concept ties to the 1 or 3 big conservative messages. And so we don't have to have, like Democrats do, of the top-down message that everybody follows along the same thing like an automaton, because that's what Democrats do, and we're not like that. I just don't know that our side recognizes that concept all that well yet. We seem to be looking for the one idea to follow.
Well, because the time for a presidential election cycle is very short. Everybody's going to be in the race is already working on that now. getting their policy proposals. They're going to have to be able to, you know, communicate in sound bites. There are, you know, so many plans out there. You were looking at the practical effect of communicating conservative ideas on one hand, and then the practical effect of tightening up and talking about a, you know, a specific here or there within a campaign. And I think we need to do both. I think you're right. One of the thoughts that came to me as you were talking about that was, I wonder if anybody's built a spreadsheet to talk about, you know, here's poverty programs, here's jobs programs, here's, you know, information on healthcare plans, and how whose proposal stacks up, and whether there's any way to track through looking at a spreadsheet what those core ideas are that we should be talking about to then drive people to look at more specifics later. I think that's a really great instinct. And, you know, I don't know if anybody's got a spreadsheet, but maybe we ought to spend some time putting one together. It would be a very, very well-read post, you know, over the years if we kept it up and maintained that, because as every new plan comes in, how does it fit into these metrics, and how does it, you know, coalesce? How do they coalesce around a single few ideas instead of all this detail? How can we say it better?
Can't we make FreedomWorks do that? Like,
I'll call them.
Okay, thank you.
I'll tell them.
Call up Dave and his brother, and we'll get some money into it, and we'll get top men on the on the project. I hope that we can get that done in an expedient fashion.
Am I the only one who, every time I hear the word expedient, and I use it myself, I think Expedia? Okay, must be me.
Sponsored. We are not sponsored by Expedia, just so that you know. We are also not sponsored. We are also not sponsored by Kurt Schlichter and the Conservative Insurgency. But this is like the third or fourth time that we're advertising it, because you know what? It's that important. Go and buy it. If you haven't already done it, read it, buy it, and buy copies for your friends, because it's that important. It's really, really good, and you should read it.
There are very few things that there's not. I'm lying. There are a lot of things that I would like all the people that I talk to read and then have lots of conversations. I would do that all day long, every day, if that's what I could get people to do. They just talk about what I've read, columns, books, things like that. But this one is huge, because it's such a diverse bunch of topics, so many things to think about. Buy the book. Yeah, just do it.
And the thing is that it's from the perspective of us. It's from our perspective. It's from the people who are in the movement and are trying to get things accomplished. That's who the characters are in this book. It is basically future us telling us how we did it. That's the premise of the book. And it does it in a pretty good way. It is effective in communicating exactly what we have to do and what our goals should be, I feel. I think Kurt Schlichter is pretty pretty smart when it comes to these things, and I would love to see it influence some more people. It's influenced me already, and we've been trying. There's a reason why we're trying to get people to read this book, just so that everybody knows. And it has nothing to do with us lining our pockets with that sweet Kurt Schlichter advertising money, which we're not getting. It's not that. It's because it's that good and that important and that relevant to what we have to get done. So, and we'll have him on eventually. I'm sure that will happen, and he'll be totally freaked out by us. He'll be like, oh God, these are the people that are reading my book. We're screwed.
He'll rethink his whole career.
Rethink everything.
No, because Leslie and I were on our best behavior when we met him, and so he thinks we're very cool.
Yes, he does.
You, I can't speak about. But we're cool.
And now I think is the time we change gears And I think we're going to experience a wee bit of Schadenfreude, which I had to say with that little German accent because it's so much fun. That is a very fun word. But let's talk about that Everytown ad. How awesome is that?
Oh, my stars.
Let me back up and do a little preface. I don't want to assume that our listeners have seen or watched it. We'll post a link to the ad. But Everytown is a moms against guns kind of group. They are absolutely opposed to people having guns to protect themselves. And they put together a commercial that they are now, that is on, it's on their YouTube page, and they've actually copied it like three or four times, addressed to specific senators, because they want their shock troops to send this video out to senators and get them to use this video as a reason to vote for gun control or to vote against people having guns. And the premise of the ad is a woman who has a restraining order against her ex-husband or ex-boyfriend, and the scene opens with boyfriend banging on the door. She's inside on the phone with 911. She says hello, and 911 says hello. And she says, you know, help me, my boyfriend's banging on the door. The 911 operator's first question is, do you have a restraining order? And she doesn't even say yes because she's screaming and her child is crying. She's got her child on the sofa, positioned in between the front door and herself. So when bad guy busts into her house, he grabs the child before she can even say anything. So this woman is horrible at protecting her own children. I mean, you just have to see the whole thing. But she's on the phone with 911, and then she's struggling with the guy who's trying to steal the child, and then the guy who has the restraining order against him, apparently, despite this restraining order, he pulls out a gun, and then we hear the gun go off. Presumably he shoots the woman, and, you know, fade to black, and now it's please call your senator and get him to make guns more illegal than they already are, or something. And it's actually a very emotional ad, particularly if you're a woman who lives alone or a woman who has children or has ever had anybody banging on the door trying to get in. It triggers a lot of emotions. It made me very grateful that I'm a gun owner. I think most people see that. Most rational people are going to see that ad and think, oh my God, she really needed a gun. She should have shot him the second he came through the door. She should have immediately put her child hiding in a closet. But, you know, to most people, that ad is an ad for gun ownership.
They really shot themselves in the foot with that ad. Sorry,
What's lovely about this to me, and it goes along with everything we've been talking about, shrinking government, making it smaller for the reasons that we need to. What is the assumption that Everytown is making here? That if government were able to restrict guns far more, then dude wouldn't have a gun, correct?
Sure.
That's their point. That's where they're going, that dude wouldn't have a gun. But did it never occur to anybody making that ad, and I'm sure it doesn't, which makes me laugh, what about the ineffectiveness of calling 911 when somebody's at your door with a gun? And this is the problem with big government, because what do people expect when they've been led to believe that you should be able to have your health care paid for, make sure that you never fall through the cracks on, you know, and that nothing bad ever happens to you, and if it does, you get to sue the pants off people. Those are all fine little concepts, but when it comes down to reality, when it comes down to something really life-threatening, where's the government? Where's big government in that scenario? They're on the other end of the phone asking, do you have a restraining order?
Amazing. Amazing, because that's what you can do. You can hold up the restraining order. You can hold it up, and instantly you're protected. It's like Harry Potter. You instantly disappear. They can't find you. It's done. You're
Because that guy... who disobeyed a law saying that he couldn't go near the wife, went near the wife with a gun that the government wants to make illegal, or these people want to make the government make illegal, so he would not violate that law? So confused.
Also, I just want to point out that while we're having this discussion right now, on Facebook, one of Fishy and my good liberal friends, very good, is trying his very hardest to make the case that the best response would have been if the person, the subject in the of the commercial, had been trained for dealing defense training. If she had defense training, because that's something that, you know, I'm sure would go over very well at all schools, that all kids mandatorily have to learn, you know, defense training. I'm sure that would be great. And of course, since all victims of crime have the exact same, you know, physical situation, you know, none of them are, you know, potentially weakened or in a state where they couldn't defend themselves physically against an attacker who is armed with a weapon. He's making the case that really education and training and happy thoughts is the correct solution, and that no, another gun, adding more guns to an already violent society would be a very bad thing, because I'm sure that mother in that commercial is a very violent person. I mean, she looks very violent to me.
I think if that woman had simply released her unicorn from his cage, then the unicorn could have kicked that bad guy's butt.
I want to say something here, because this gun argument really drives me crazy from these women. I'm short, and if people didn't know that, I'm not even 5 foot tall. In a world in which I'm not allowed to purchase a gun, and there are people that are the size of JD with bad intentions, JD is significantly taller than 5 foot, I'm just going to say. The people that are built like JD are going to be the people who are going to win in a one-on-one confrontation with me if I'm unable to arm myself.
Right. No matter how much Taekwondo training you have, JD is going to be able to kick your butt.
Yes. Yes. Although, you know, I've got him significantly, you know, cowed, and he doesn't believe that that's true. It nevertheless is. But don't tell him, okay? Because I like him, you know, being worried about things.
And about protecting yourself at distance. You're in the kitchen. The kid's in the living room. Bad guy busts in the front door.
Bark like a chihuahua.
You can shoot the guy. You can't taekwondo from a distance.
And you know, I've got short arms. My swing is not the greatest. Even just a baseball bat isn't going to cut it in that scenario. I'm going to lose that baseball bat, and it's going to end up right here on my face. It's just the way it is. So people who argue about that are looking to bring back the strong being in charge.
Right.
That might makes right. That is what they're bringing back.
And talk about discriminating against the disabled.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody who is handicapped is certainly not going to be able to taekwondo their way out of it. You know, my nephew is not, I'm not as short as Fishy, and my nephew is not as tall as JD, but he has, just when we were joking around, he has put his hand on my forehead and prevented me from swinging at him. We've done that. You know, the thing that you see in cartoons where the little person is swinging like crazy and the one guy's just got his hand on your forehead and, you know, laughing at you. Yeah, my nephew's done that to me. It's legit. It happens. Now, if I had a gun, I could have capped his butt. Not that I would have, because he's my nephew and I love him. But
see, I laughed at that, and then I realized, Oh God, I shouldn't have laughed at that because I'm the one in that situation who would wind up with a bullet in his ass. That's not good. Should not have laughed at that. Dang.
That's okay. We're all drunk, so whatever. Oh, no, wait. None of us are drunk, are we?
No,
We're
no.
just silly.
On this same exact subject, in fact, and we're talking about how unfair and how ridiculous it is to apply these one-size-fits-all solutions, because again, that's what it was. Of course, every single victim could be prevented, victimization could be prevented if they had proper training. Of course it could. Of course it could. Of course it could be resolved physically with an expertly timed karate chop. I think that it's a good point to mention that Jean-Pierre Mialy has an excellent article on this subject apt today, talking about how insane it is that the left is not pro-gun, because it is an equalizer of such a great magnitude against, talk about the war on women, an actual war on actual women.
Right.
When it comes to rapists and violent thugs and victims of crime, talking about gays who have been it's
Victimized
well
for
documented,
years.
that they are subjects of violent abuse. Any kind, go down the list. If these people had weapons, had guns to defend themselves, how many tragedies could have been prevented?
Well, and there was an interview with an elderly black lady in a crime-ridden neighborhood, and somebody was interviewing her. Why do you own a gun, Miss Mamie? I've lived here 57 years, and I'm not going to move. And the punks outside, they know I'm armed, and they're not going to break in because I'll shoot them. I may be weak, I may not be able to beat them up, but I've got my gun here, and I can defend myself. I mean, she has the gun. She feels in control of her own life, and she has the confidence to be able to live in that neighborhood and work towards a better future for herself and her neighbors. A woman with a gun has the confidence and the control over her own life and is able to protect and care for her children.
Who's controlling her life? Is it the government?
Yeah, right? I want to control my own life, not yours. And that whole ad, this woman was being victimized by her boyfriend, husband, whatever, and she was calling someone to help her. She was calling for Big Daddy to control and help her because she is weak and helpless. Whereas the counter ad is that Glock ad that we've seen, that where it's, the woman all by herself in her apartment, and she hears somebody, banging on the door. She goes and gets the Glock out of the safe, and guy busts in the door. She points the gun at him. He passes out. You picked the wrong woman is the punchline on the commercial. That's a woman who is not afraid. She's empowered. She's in control of her own life and her own destiny. That's an independent woman who is e who has equality with a man. In fact, that's equality of outcome. She's every bit as strong. And I don't understand why liberals can't get their head around that.
It's because they're sexist.
Do you think about the cartwheels, the mental cartwheels that they have to do here? What is the general premise that most liberals start with? That people are mostly good, that people are wonderful and they'll do the right thing given the chance. All of their programs tend towards people intending really good, and therefore it's going to work out, right? And yet, they are countervening that entire argument by saying, oh, but yet they cannot be trusted to defend themselves.
I think a lot of
But
it
they're
has to do
naturally
with.
good, they're not naturally smart. See, that's the thing. They're not smart enough.
A lot of it goes back to, I think, public education, where you're taught to think as everyone else thinks, and what your teacher or those who are hold some type of authority over you in that kind of situation, tell you what to do, and then they parrot it back, and they're taught to answer the tests the way they've been, according to what they've been taught. And it goes along with what they get from the media, what they get from the politicians who spin things. And like you said, JD, they don't stop and think for themselves.
I think that they would if they got if things were presented in a way that is not incredibly skewed to really ridiculousness at this point about information regarding guns, information knowing anything about guns, knowing anything about the regulations and what people have to, the hoops that people have to go through in order to currently obtain weapons, obtain these guns. I think that people would be shocked. I think that they would absolutely be shocked with what goes on.
Well, and what Delbert said just reminded me, why do you think we have hyperventilating over Pop-Tart shaped guns in school? It's the propaganda. It's not the threat.
I would like to see a Pop-Tart shaped gun, but it was actually a gun shaped Pop-Tart.
That thing, what you said. Yeah. A Pop-Tart shaped gun. See, that's concealed carry all on its own.
Oh, heck yeah. Frosted brown sugar cinnamon.
Yeah, and a healthy snack when you're here. An unhealthy snack, you know.
Yeah,
that's like what the whole thing is. That's what the whole campaign at those schools about. If you point your finger like a gun, if you have a pastry that's shaped like a gun, if you have any of these things, it's that whole thing of making a whole generation feel very uncomfortable with the concept of guns. And then they can ask, of course, do your parents have guns in your house?
Oh yeah. That was mentioned earlier this week that's on VA questionnaires, and doctors are now being required to ask all sorts of invasive questions that are then going to be used against you. And my God, if you're a vet, they're asking these questions about, do you have guns in the house? And then you're going to be treated for PTSD, and then that's on your permanent record, and then you're never going to be able to legally own a gun again. And there's so much going on where if you look at things that seem so very separated, and then you start to tie it all together and realize how deeply in trouble we are, and how on a lot of things, when people ask you questions, that for many of them, and it's both from when companies ask and certainly when the government asks, if it's not directly related, I think we have to just say, I decline to answer. I think that's the only safe answer.
That goes along with those who say they don't want gun control. They just want to register people, and then they want to know what is the mindset of the people who are getting the guns. And then they can come along and find some reason why you don't have the right mindset and take my mindset and then take the gun away from you.
Well, and that's exactly what they started with vets, because really, are we that passionate about defending the rights of our veterans when we were letting them go get their health care from the Veterans Administration? So vets, were a pretty easy target at first. And the mentally ill, people that had been not just mentally ill, but been treated for some mental issue, not necessarily illness, but issue. And then they start the next group, and then the next group, and then the next group. Who's going to defend them by the time they get to us?
Right. Oh, we need to know because you have children in the house, and we need to know if the children are safe. Decline to answer. I'm not going to lie, because if you find out that I lied, then you use that against me. That I lied on a government form or whatever. But I think if I decline to answer, I think I'm safe. I don't know. And nobody's asked me these invasive questions, but, you go to the doctor's office, I've got the flu. Do you have a gun at your house? It's just on my form. And so many times we will, you know, the nurse or somebody is, they're just filling out a form. They're just asking question after question. Yes, no, yes, no. And we, because we are trusting people, we will habitually just go through and we'll just answer those questions. I think we have to start questioning the questioners. And even if they don't have decline to answer as an option, I think we have to give that to them. To protect ourselves.
You know, one thing I will say about this this commercial is that, and I think that we all really we missed this from the beginning, is that it's really too bad that it wasn't a rape situation, that wasn't what the scenario was. It's too bad because everybody knows that in the event of a rape, you can shut the attacker down by, you know, crapping your pants and peeing yourself. And that is the
That's better than a restraining order, in fact.
Oh,
yeah.
And it's far better than having a gun. It's just far, far better. These are the actual things that liberals put out there as effective strategies for dissuading attackers, for dissuading rapists.
Whatever happened to that whole teach men not to rape thing? I mean, can we stop there and can we just pause on that for a second? Wasn't that sort of the big answer to it all? And then we turn up with, I guess it was Julie Borowski who was saying, teach people not to steal. How intelligent is that?
And that was they started with that whole concept with the whole bullying thing where it was teach them not to bully. You know, don't fight back against a bully. Just teach the bully not to bully. Oh, okay. Well, yeah, thousands of years of society, that actually is what parents have been doing. Because as a parent, I'm not a parent, so I don't know these things. I just kind of assume, because I had parents, that the job is to transmit information from parent to child about how to behave effectively in society. And that includes things like be nice to people, don't be a bully, don't steal, don't rape, don't murder. Those sorts of things were what parents taught children. Is that still a thing?
Well, there's this ongoing, and it's been going on my whole life, that if you educate everyone enough, then we'll have peace because everyone will know that all these things are wrong. So that encompasses everything we're talking about, and they don't put any, they don't connect that Hitler was an educated, intelligent man, and you can go on with all kinds of people who've done horrible things in the world. They were intelligent, so that has no bearing on whether someone's going to do what's right or wrong.
Woodrow Wilson was quite intelligent.
Yep.
And he believed in the whole rule of the nation by just a cabal of very effective, intelligent bureaucrats. And we're currently living in the hell that he created. But fortunately, our founders believed that men were coated bastards with bastard filling. And if everybody recognizes the show that comes from? No? That comes from Scrubs, and it was, I'll find the clip to that, because it was Perry Cox on Scrubs calling people coated bastards with bastard filling. And that's what our founders believed people were, and they built a system to create bounty and freedom and delight and prosperity in spite of people being such. And they were correct, and they were successful in what they planned and what they created. The whole utopia thing, that's kind of what Marx and Lenin and Stalin and all of those guys have tried to create. And that seems to have not worked all that well.
Well, it depends on what you mean by well. I mean, it was pretty effective for what they wanted to accomplish.
Which was being in charge, being rich, and if a couple million people had to die, who cares?
Well, it's acceptable losses. That's, up there with the whole, ends justify the means thing. By the way, I just want to give a quick update for everyone about our good liberal friend. He's responded to that women should just, you know, pee themselves in the event of an attack thing with, oh, well, it's hard to fight that logic. Of course, you could take a class that would consist of several hours, or spend a few hundred dollars for the gun, then buy the bullets, then take a safety course, then go to a range and practice and get a concealed carry license, and then hope not to shoot an innocent bystander when attacked. That's the length that the guy has to go to. He's trying
wow.
to... Oh, now it's just inconvenient. It's amazing. It is beautiful. I don't know how you can look at that thread and say, yeah, I agree with you. I agree. That's what we should be supporting is we shouldn't think about arming women. We should think about the ridiculous regulations and the trouble that it would, you know, it's so much trouble to get a gun, so she shouldn't get a gun because it's so much trouble.
She should probably just lay back and accept it. You know, if it's going to happen, you just lay back and accept it. He's probably a good father. He'll probably be a good father to the child anyway.
Thank you, Clayton Williams.
Yeah, but I knew you'd get that.
I think I'm just going to rent somebody JD's size to follow me around. Then I don't have to worry about it, right?
Yeah.
That wouldn't be very spendy at all.
Well, in the liberal thinking, we need to decide if you should do that or not. So I haven't made up my mind yet.
And if and since this is a democracy, it does need to be majority rule.
Well, so that would be bad news for Bloomberg. Bloomberg, how tall is Bloomberg?
Oh, he's short, isn't he?
So if he didn't have bodyguards, you might be in trouble if somebody were to, like, you know, I don't know.
Don't you notice that most of the people who are advocating the liberal policies don't actually live under liberal policies?
The thing is, and the thing that we're failing to recognize is the fact that Michael Bloomberg should have a gun, and it is right for him to have a gun because he's a billionaire and very smart and would only use the gun in the appropriate manner, at the appropriate time. So that is where our whole comparison breaks down there, because it's Michael Bloomberg, and he's, you know, he knows what he's doing. So we're good. We're good with that.
I think it brings us somewhat full circle back to what we were talking about laws, is that most of the, well, I can't say that. The liberal people I talk to, they want the laws for other people, but then they want to selectively apply them to themselves or not.
Rules for thee, but not for me. Yeah.
Right. And that's it does cycle back to earlier in the show where we were talking about consistent application of the law is actual fairness. And that is... fairness is another one of the messages, because that's a phrase that resonates really well with millennials, and I think with all people of good conscience. We want things to be as fair as they possibly can. I mean, most of us are adults, and we understand the world isn't fair, but when we can create, as a society, when we can create a set of laws and apply them in a way that is as fair as possible, that's actually better and is conducive to prosperity and happiness. And that's where I think a lot of the conservative versus liberal stuff happens, is that you're right. The liberal policies tend to be the kind of things they want applied to other people, and they themselves are exempt for one reason or another. And yet they call their stuff fairness when it's absolutely the opposite. I'm not sure how we counter I'm not sure how we counter the conventional wisdom that liberals are all about fairness and conservatives are all about the richer 1%. I mean, the facts are diametrically opposed to that, but that's what the public thinks.
Well, they think it because they've been told it, and they repeat it because they've never been challenged on it in an effective way. But when we take those liberal policies and we put them out there with the results of the said policies in a way that's, you know, easy for people to understand, it's quite clear. Why is it that there's a Canadian immigrant who wants to be a med student who can't get in to the medical school he wants to go to because he can't afford the tuition rates because he's paying out-of-state tuition, whereas people that come across the border illegally in the same state are getting in-state tuition? How is that fundamentally fair for that guy or for anyone?
That story was so shocking to me because I've long supported, not long supported, but I've been okay with Texas granting in-state tuition to illegals who have lived here for ages, because when you live in Texas, you pay Texas sales tax, and college tuition is that's a state financial decision, so I've been kind of okay with that. But I would have assumed that in-state tuition also applied to whatever status that Canadian guy has, where he's a resident alien. He's lived. I would have assumed that he also would pay in-state tuition because he's been a resident of the state for umpteen years. But in finding out that, and this is in Florida, who may have different laws than Texas, but that guy has lived in that state for 15 years, he should qualify for in-state tuition too because he's paid those state income taxes. So when I read that and found that he was not eligible for in-state tuition, that torqued me off considerably.
And looking at that, that's a fairness issue. How do those things happen? You lift up, the policy is to be good and special, you know, get special privileges for X group. But when you do that, you always end up hurting somebody else. It's never going to be fair. Someone's always going to feel the sting of corrective policies or beneficial policies for one group. We just have to be able to articulate that in a clear and simple way, and I think we can start stealing that fairness label away from them.
I'd like to. I think we should. And and we need to get, I don't know, insistent about it and bold about it. And we, in general, I think we need to get bolder about countering the liberal narratives. I don't know if I mean, and I know I don't mean disagreeing with them and fighting back, because I generally think that disagreeing with a committed liberal is a waste of time, but stealing their messaging, being subversive about it perhaps, countering it in a way that isn't like a direct confrontational thing. I think we do need to get bolder about it rather than just saying, oh, well, the left owns the fairness thing, and they always say that. Oh, well, what can we do? Find a way to steal their phrases and twist them against them. Do a little jujitsu about it. I'm not really creative about it. I don't know how.
Well, our jujitsu master, Andy, is away. Hopefully he'll be back next week. Him and Corey will be back to give us a wrap-up of their adventures over the past 2 weeks.
2 weeks away. It's unforgivable.
Yes, absolutely. But one of the things that instantly comes to mind when we're having this discussion about, about firearms and about the Second Amendment and fairness and all of this, a lot of people fail to recognize, I read an excellent article on this at Reason.com this week that I didn't share, but I probably should have, about how everything that Martin Luther King Jr., all the entire movement could not have happened if it weren't for armed black Americans. Couldn't have happened. Nonviolent, resisting, absolutely great. They needed legally armed citizens having firearms to defend them in a lot of places. So the civil rights movement
did have that.
And,
yeah.
Yes, it depended entirely on that happening. I mean, if that guarantee was not there, if these guys did not have weapons, if they did not have guns, we're looking at a whole lot of different stuff happening. We're looking at an entirely different society. We're looking at a whole different picture. And you know who brings this message of Second Amendment rights to black communities? Is it the Democrats?
No.
Is that who does it?
No.
Oh, well then who is it?
That would be Rand Paul is the one who's done it most recently.
It's us. We have to do it. We have to get in there. We have to do it. And you know, I think that's a message that's pretty strong. That, you know, the reason that we have the system that we have today is because of armed black Americans fighting for their rights. That's
okay.
George
is saying in the chat that somebody was on Twitter, which I don't even pay attention to Twitter. I don't have the ability to follow conversations. My brain doesn't work that way. But during the Netroots Nation conference, somebody was using the left's words against them on Twitter, and that's the kind of thing we need to do a lot more of. And I think the gun rights and JD, you and I were tossing the story back about this just a few minutes before the show started. That article, Breitbart had an article that showed what the conversation was on The View this morning. Apparently on The View they looked at that Everytown ad, and we all know The View is three liberals and one less than liberal. And I think the expectation with that ad was that The View would be a great place to show that ad and have the discussion about how bad guns are and guns should not be in the home and we really need to pass this legislation and remove guns. Well, the reality was Sherry Shepard and Jenny McCarthy and was it Juliette Huddy? There was somebody from Fox News on there as well. Those three women, they both said, they didn't say they had guns in the home. I think the Fox woman may have implied that she did. But both Jenny McCarthy and Sherry Shepard related personal stories of when they were in their home with their child and they were afraid. And Sherry's story was, I'm trying to protect my child and I realize all I have is a damn wicker garbage bag. Damn wicker garbage can. I really wish I had had a gun. And Jenny was telling a story about sometime when she was afraid in her home. She said, if you've never been that afraid, I wish I had had a gun. And these were liberal women on The View, and they put themselves in the position of being in the home and afraid and needing to protect their child. And they realized that having a gun in the home is the way for a woman to care for and protect the family that she's responsible for and the home that she's responsible for. And that was very surprising to me that the conservative message reached over, and it really isn't a conservative message, but it's the pro-gun stance is considered a conservative thing, but it was quite easily and readily adapted by the liberals on The View. And, you know, I may scoff at The View, but millions of women watch that, and that's women in the home with their children. And those women saying to the women who were watching, you know what, having a gun in your home is kind of a good thing. That was a really powerful, that must have been a very powerful moment. And it may be the kind of thing, if we need to capitalize on that and share that story out, because what happens when you share the story out, the cover photo of the story is the women from The View. And what I saw when I shared the story out, even though it was a story on Breitbart, the link was clearly to Breitbart, the picture was people of The View. Non-political people who follow me are going to click that story, or they're going to read the introduction that I wrote, because it's not a super obvious political story. It wasn't like it was John Boehner. It was, hey, this is a pop culture story. I'll read it. And then they go, oh, it's a pop culture story about The View, and it's about guns, and it's about protecting my home, and it's about protecting my children, and this makes sense. And it's not political, but it's logical, and that's the way to get the message out to people who are not necessarily political. I think that's pretty cool. And I think that's the kind of thing, that's the way to turn the liberal message on itself, these are liberals protecting your home, war on women. I mean, I think we can do it. It just takes some, I don't know, art. I don't know.
I think that it doesn't take all that much art at all, and I think that it's something that we can do effectively, and I think it's a great way to think about the subject and to realize that, yeah, these are common sense.
Right.
These are common sense answers to difficult problems, and it's not just a conservative thing. We're just the party who has these common sense answers.
And, you know, I think the great thing about the way that you presented it, Leslie, too, is that when we are looking to message that to other people, what we're ending up with is telling folks, you know, this is what so-and-so has said, this is what that's happening. And then we come back here and we refine those messages. That's why we're the refinery. But the great part is what we say here and what we clip out and people end up watching, that's going to spark other people's ideas. We're going to be seeing, hopefully, people responding to the, you know, and it's no fair cheating and telling everybody, you know, trying to take the easy path and going, I don't know. And then just, you know, waiting for somebody else to come. You know it's going to happen. But, I mean, that's part of what we're doing is putting the ideas out there. People are going to run with that. People are going to think about the concepts, and they're going to find better ways. I certainly don't have, you know, a lot of creativity in that area, but I'll bet you we have people that are watching that do. That is the smooth part of this operation, is that we could talk about it, but we can make somebody else do the work.
Like your question about the spreadsheet. Wouldn't it be nice if we had? Wonder if there's a meme that could be done for that. Yeah. Yeah. There was, earlier this week, it occurred to me that clearly Rand Paul also watches The Refinery or reads all of us, because a couple of weeks ago, several times that I said, hey, I really like most of what Rand Paul says, but I wish he would stop attacking us. He's attacking the Tea Party. He needs to find a better way to say what he's wanting to say without also attacking us and currying favor with the news media. Well, you know what? He stopped doing that. I haven't heard him attacking the Tea Party in a while. He's stating his case. He's making his case. He's not feeling the necessity to state his case and also attack us. He's getting better. I had said, I hope he gets better and I hope he learns and practices. And he has taken our advice. So many people listen to The Refinery. We're awesome.
They're just on the DL about it. That's all.
Yes. Hey, Kevin.
Speaking of listening to The Refinery, everybody, please share and like and subscribe to the channel and do all of those awesome things that, you know, helps get videos, views, and stuff, because I think we talk about a lot of important things here on The Refinery, and it would be nice if more people came here to talk about them in the chat with us. And,
yes.
You know, who knows what else? There's a ton of other stuff that would be great to get these messages out and see maybe somebody send a letter to Susana Martinez to get something done in regards to the 10th Amendment issues in New Mexico, any of these things. You know, there's stuff that we can do just by sharing that does a lot. And I think it's a really cool thing that people are watching our videos and you know, sharing them and coming back to see more content from The Refinery.
Absolutely. And our one-hour meeting has progressed to its usual two-hour length. Does anybody have any closing remarks?
Follow at CU Organization on Twitter, at Free Radical Net on Twitter, and at Party of Choice on Twitter. That's what you should do. You should do all of those things.
And if you know what's good for you. Because, yes, Conservative Insurgency by Kurt Schlichter. And that will wrap us up for another week. We will see you again next Tuesday at 8:30 Central. And the website, conservativeunion.net/refinery, and be on the lookout throughout the week because JD and Felicia do excellent work of finding 5 to 10 minute snippets of this conversation, which are worthy of listening and sharing with all your friends. Thanks for joining us. We will see you guys next week.